She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
Hi, and welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Tie and War Drums, perfect for carrying out your military witch hunts from, and they carry a pretty sweet beat too. I'm Charlie Etheridge-Nunn, a writer and an Event Horizon fan.
And I'm Marzuri Lobato, a science fiction writer and a fan of the Disney post-Star Wars cash-in, The Black Hole, which I advise everyone to watch. Because you're going to be in for an insane fucking time.
Well, after listening to this, of course.
Of course.
Of course. Each episode, we watch stories from three different Star Trek shows and rank them on a big list from best to worst. We both love Star Trek, but as it's far from our first fandom, that makes us the ultimate objective voices on such a task. This episode, we're having a bit of a deep dive into a fundamental part of Star Trek's showrunners and writers, the recently passed Jeri Taylor. Now, she was born in 1938 and wrote for a lot of shows like Little House on the Prairie and The Incredible Hulk, eventually getting hired to work on Star Trek The Next Generation in season 4, where she was brought on as a producer and a writer. Eventually even helping to develop Star Trek Voyager, where she was the EP, a writer, showrunner, even working as a consultant after she retired. She wrote over 30 episodes of Star Trek and produced several more. And we thought it would be a good way to honour her, to kind of have a look at a few of Jeri Taylor's episodes. She also wrote a few different Star Trek novels, including at the same time as doing the TV script for Star Trek Next Generation's Unification Part 1. She also wrote the novel all in the course of a month. And of course, it is that cover that's famous for looking kind of like Spock has smelt a bit of a fart.
And which episode was that, do you remember, of the show where we covered Unification?
Oh, God, that was episode 52. So, yeah, if people want to check that out, we had Sean Corse guest starring on it, and it was a good fun time. So, before we go into a few slightly older Star Trek episodes that she wrote, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying this week?
Well, I have been discovering, a few years ago, I checked out the first few episodes of the show Elementary, which was the, I think, NBC attempt to kind of cash in on the modern day Sherlock kind of craze as populated by Sherlock. When it was first announced, I admittedly dismissed it as just, oh, this is going to be Sherlock without any of the quality.
Oh, same.
And I watched like 5 minutes of the first episode. I was like, no, there are no cool flashy cityscapes. There's no cool stuff done with visuals, with texting. It's not set in England, so therefore bad. And then I started watching it. And I'm like, actually, no, this is actually a quite enjoyable weekly procedural with Johnny Lee Miller and Lucy Liu as Holmes and Watson, respectively. And there were it's just enjoyable. It's also less pretentious than Sherlock, which admittedly
not
as much as I enjoy Sherlock, Sherlock does disappear up its own ass round about season 2. And yeah, like, and also I just really miss like having a weekly murder mystery procedural show, which is like 26, you know, like 23 episodes. You get a new case every week. There's some undercurrents going on. They're done. Good.
Nice. Yeah, it's been a little while since I've seen a kind of regular serialized show like that, where it's not been, you know, like 10 episode prestige thing or anything. Yeah, it's weird because it must have been, you know, less than a decade ago that I was like, yep, all of those CW DC shows and countless other things. But yeah, it's not so much of a thing now.
And Charlie, what about you? What a non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying this week?
Well, I've been enjoying the new version of Ranma. It's Ranma is currently on Netflix as an anime show. I was a big fan of it back in the day when it was a manga being translated over into English. It was, I think, a second manga I read after Battle Angel Alita, and it really kicked off my love of Rumiko Takahashi's work. It's just...
Okay, you have just dated yourself. Yeah. What was the first manga you kind of read back in the 90s? Like, the first manga I properly read was Akira.
Of course.
And not just any part of Akira. The final chapter of Akira, when it was being serialized in the comic Manga Mania.
Oh, wow.
So, like, I was like, what the F is going... Because, like, it opens, and it's all a cosmic psychic shit as Kaneda is being sucked through Tetsuo's brain at the very end of the story.
Good. So, yeah, a nice normal strip to read.
Yeah, it's really funny how different... I know a lot of anime fans in the US of the same age, and it's always kind of funny because how... anime was promoted and produced and released in the UK and the US in the like mid to late 90s was wildly different. Because like their first encounter with stuff like, you know, Pokemon or Sailor Moon, and I'm like, I'll be honest, it was Free by Free Eyes, which is gory and has a lot of boobs, because manga anime was very much released and promoted towards like college age guys.
Yeah.
So there was a good chance that what you were watching was porn with the porn taken out.
Well, yeah, and comic wise, they were American size comics that had like one, maybe two stories in instead of the normal manga collections. So I remember like 20p and 50p comic boxes being full of the stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the day. And yeah, with random kind of numbering patterns as well. But yeah, Ranma is a gloriously weird series. It's about, it's kind of slapstick martial arts romantic comedy, but where the protagonist, Ranma, is an idiot, and his dad, who is terrible at parenting and training him, they go around China, getting in a lot of fights and getting into a lot of scrapes, and both fall into different cursed springs. And now, whenever Ranma falls into... Well, whenever Ranma's splashed with cold water, he turns into a girl. And whenever Genma Saotome, his father, gets hit with cold water, he becomes a giant panda. And hot water turns him back. And Ranma happens to have been promised away to one of Genma's mates to marry one of his daughters, and of course ends up engaged to an aggressive tomboy out of the three daughters, Akane. And like the way they both hate each other but also kind of are into each other, but neither has the emotional maturity or smarts to figure any of this out, while rival after rival pops up, like either to destroy or be in love with one, the other, or both of them. It's increasingly bonkers, and it's been good fun watching a modern anime version.
Yeah, I've been Rihanna and I have been watching it as well, and the fight choreography is amazing.
Yeah.
The use of like colors and changing the mood and tone to sometimes switch into like looking more like a comic panel has been a lot of fun. I liked the introduction to, I think it was episode 3, when it looks like a side-scrolling Street Fighter-style martial arts game.
Yeah.
Which, of course, there was a Ranma one-half Street Fighter clone for Super Nintendo back in the 90s. And, yeah, like you said, Ranma is a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
Admittedly, like, you know, when you kind of get into these kind of anime, manga, kind of what they call harem shows. The main male character usually has like the backbone of a wet noodle, so a lot of the punishment that gets distributed on them is very much undeserved. Looking at you, Love Hina. But with Ranma's case, usually Ranma's responsible for at least 50% of the bad things that happen to him, because he, at no, like you said, he has the emotional intelligence of a slug and never stops to go, should I have said that?
Oh god, yeah. Yeah, of course.
Meanwhile, Genma Saotome, his father, might actually surpass Gendo Ikari from Neon Genesis Evangelion in who is the worst fucking parent of all time in anime. And I watch Gundam, so there are a lot of you are the worst father of all time, sir. But I swear, Genma Saotome at one point does marry his son off for a food cart,
which yeah,
he promptly steals. And it's, and people going about how Goku in Dragon Ball Z is the worst father of all time. Like, no, like Goku, for all his faults and sometimes picking fighting over good parental skills, clearly loves his son more than Genma Saotome does.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
It's would like, he trade the son away for food?
No. And Goku loves food, but he's self-sufficient. He knows how to... He clearly knows how to fish, as we see from Dragon Ball, whereas Genma is just like, I could sell my son again. I'm sure I've broken several tax laws.
Like, it's that or go down for Piggly Wiggly, and I can't be arsed, so let's just sell the son. Yeah.
Yeah, I think my favorite is in a later bit of the manga, where we find out that Ranma has a phobia of cats.
Oh, God.
Because Genma found this book which had something called the Cat Fist, which is you wrap the person you want to train the cat fist with meat and then drop them into a basement full of rabid cats, but did this before turning the page and seeing the little note saying, anyone who does this is a goddamn moron.
Yeah. And what a shock. Rama's got a fear of cats after that.
Yeah, to the point where he actually, if he is stuck around cats for too long, he mentally becomes a cat, because that's the only way this psychologically damaged 15-year-old can cope.
Oh, God. What fun. I can't wait to reach that bit.
It's great. And yeah, have you been watching it subbed or dubbed?
Subbed.
Okay, because I think the sub uses a lot of the original voice cast from the original anime, like Megumi Hayabashi, who does Girl Ranma, and I can never remember the name of the male voice actor. The English dub has been good, although the guy they have playing Kuno sounds like he's 30.
Oh, dear. But
to be fair, given how fucking dumb Tatewake Kuno is, I buy it.
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, this isn't a Ranma podcast, despite the last few minutes. And yeah, my kind of, I don't know, it's been so long since I've read Ranma that it's been nice going back to it. This is a Star Trek podcast, and our first episode for night is Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 4, Episode 17, titled Night Terrors. This aired on the 18th of March, 1991, with a teleplay by Pamela Douglas and Jerry Taylor, story by Shari Goodhartz, which I thought was a pseudonym, but couldn't see anything that said that it was, and directed by Les Landau, who'll do a couple of tonight's episodes. The UK number one hit is The Clash with Should I Stay or Should I Go? And the US had the shrill harbinger of festive horror, Mariah Carey, with Someday. I wasn't as horrified by Someday as I was with a lot of her work, but, yeah.
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 I feel like we need to note that the reason why The Clash was the UK number one was that there was a popular Levi's commercial which brought it back into the public eye. Because I did briefly have a... listeners remember the one episode where we one of the songs was "I Would Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That" by Meatloaf. And we kind of fell into a temporal black hole of, when did this song come out? So I did have to quickly go to Wikipedia to go, when did Should I Stay or Should I Go come out? Because it was not 1991, but no. Goddamn, what a banger.
Oh my God, so good. Yeah, we were raised with The Clash from a young age by my father. So, yeah, always enjoy listening to them.
I was raised on Tom Waits, Patti Smith, and the Traveling Wilburys. So the fact that I don't have like a severe marijuana habit is quite surprising, I'll be honest.
Yeah. I'll be recapping this one. And I've been having some poor sleep, which feels fitting for this. So yeah, we'll see how I do.
Okay, and engage.
So, the Enterprise has found some binary stars, which is pretty cool, and the USS Britain, which went missing and is currently unresponsive. Troy senses life on board, but something's wrong with it. An away team of basically most of the cast check it out and find a lot of corpses. There's a single survivor, a catatonic betazoid. Crusher's been doing autopsies, and the 34 people that were on the crew murdered each other. The Betazoid, Andrus, is still catatonic, telepathically talking to Troy about voices. Troy explores further into his mind, floating through a weird green space with voices whispering and the binary stars in the distance and clouds everywhere. She wakes up with a start. She's been dreaming of this again and again. There's been little progress with LaForge and the others on the Britain. They're going to tow the ship to a nearby starbase. And an ensign on the Britain thinks he's heard something, but probably not, shrugs it off. O'Brien starts pacing angrily in his quarters, and when Kiko comes in to talk about her day, he loses his shit about another scientist who he's jealous of. He storms off and goes to 10 forward, where an ensign Gillespie starts telling him all about tales of ghosts and hallucinations happening all over the ship. Picard sits on in his office when the doorbell goes off again and again. No one's there. Is someone trying to prank him? It keeps going and he tries to ignore it, only for it to actually be Crusher and Troy. They mention reports of erratic behavior going on. Need to get away from these stars. The ship tries to leave, but an ensign's having trouble how to remember, how to tow the ship, and someone else is brought in their place. Doesn't really matter, though, as the ship won't go. Time passes, and the Enterprise is still stuck by the binary stars. Power's beginning to go, and they're no further in how to leave this system. People are really knackered and getting weird about it. Data's the only one unaffected and presents his findings about something called Tychon's Rift, not easily visible and draining the power from the engines. They need to figure out how to explode their way out, but can't replicate anything complex to do it. Picard looks rough as a badger's arse and sends Riker off to try and get some sleep. Then he hallucinates a shrinking lift, and Riker's no better. He hallucinates snakes in his bed. Oh, God. Data suggests trying an anti-Borg solution, basically bouncing energy off a deflector dish. Sure, we'll give it a try. Picard's getting a bit worried about deteriorating like his granddad did and might need Data to take over for him. We see the Enterprise morgue full of the bodies from the Britain in white body bags. Crusher's left alone there, and after a moment, we look back and the bodies are all sat upright. She closes her eyes, concentrates, and they weren't sat up. They never moved, but it's a nice creepy moment. Crusher asks if Picard remembers any dreams he's had lately, and no, he doesn't remember dreaming at all. In fact, everyone is having that same problem, everyone apart from Troy, who's having nightmares. There's some kind of chemical imbalance affecting their REM sleep, and if it doesn't stop, they'll all go insane. Troy's back in the weird floaty dream space, hearing voices, and she's worried she'll end up like Andress soon enough. Gillespie is in 10 Ford, going full Alex Jones about everything, saying, oh, it's a conspiracy, we're being experimented on. The anti-Borg beam fails, and Worf runs off like he's desperate for a slash, and Troy manages to stop him from stabbing himself. After all this, Data's in command, and life support's not looking good. Troy hears something about eyes in the dark from Andress's mind, realizes what's up. There's some kind of entity on the other side trying to communicate. They're affecting REM waves, stopping everyone else from dreaming, but not the beta side, as their brains are wired a bit differently. Data tries to help Troy with a message sent via a dream. He's trying a bit too much, and she realizes, oh, they're talking about hydrogen with a circle in a circle. They need to get some and detonate it from the other side. Troy's put to sleep, and everyone's put in emergency zones while life support's drained. She floats around asking the entity where it is, eventually seeing a glowing thing out there. The Enterprise runs out of hydrogen to fire into the rift, and an explosion happens from the other side, blasting them free. Now it's time for everyone to have a nap.
Oh! Oh!
Oh!
Oh!
Wow!
Oh, you did it, sir! 5 minutes!
I did not think that I would get that.
I am proud of you, sir. You did it.
Poof. Oh, dear.
Just as the alarm went off. I have a question for you.
Go on.
Have you seen the Doctor Who episode called Night Terrors, where Matt Smith, Karen Gillan, and Rory get stuck in a dollhouse?
Yes. Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen it. Yeah, there have been a lot of Night Terrors named episodes, I'm sure.
I think this was definitely much better.
Yes. Yeah, this was a good, fun episode. I liked the horror-y vibe of it all. And to be honest, if I was on the Britannia, I wouldn't have been a fan. It was very cramped looking.
Yeah, I do want to quickly quote a line from The Martian because you reminded me of it.
Mm.
Luckily, in the history of humanity, nothing bad has ever happened from lighting hydrogen on fire.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, here it helps.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I did enjoy this episode. I did enjoy the brief kind of Silent Hill vibes.
Oh, God. The creepiness was so fun.
Especially, like, the bit with the corpses. If only because, like, the one corpse on, like, Crusher's... On screen left, Crusher's right.
Mm.
To be all actory about it. Has, like, these really dark eye holes, which you can see. I'm like, oh, God. Was that intentional? Or they just found, like, the guy with the most shrunken... recessed eye sockets and went, right, you get on that gurney.
Oh, that was so much fun. I had a few moments of going back and forth about what is this? Is it that the Betazoids got some kind of brain thing going on, like some kind of Betazoid Alzheimer's, and that's why everyone else died there and why everything's going here? And then it's like, no, it's a completely different alien entity from the Rift. So, okay, that's fine. Yeah, why not? It explains some of the oddness with the dreams and the kind of words and symbols that were going on. The dream sequence was weird as well. Like, we don't often see strange dreams in that kind of fashion, but like, yeah, apparently Marina Sirtis wanted some action scenes and stunt things, and this is what they did for her. And she has a fear of heights. Yeah, didn't go well with this. The weird kind of other ship felt pretty old and odd. Like, it was had this kind of mint green vibe to the bridge.
Mm.
And when they said, oh yeah, there's 34 people on board, it's like, okay, that explains why it's so tiny. Apparently it was reused from Reliant in Star Trek 2.
Yeah, I think it's the same kind of model. Mm. Although I do have to correct you, because you did the same error that the show did.
By
you kept referring to it as REM sleep when it's actually REM sleep.
Fine, REM sleep.
I thought I really wanted for a moment that they're having problems with their REM levels, so we're putting on some Radiohead instead. Maybe that was all about. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It might be a bit of a downer for them.
Look, at this point, you know, it's either going to be like Radiohead or Tears for Fears.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking maybe you too. But I think that might mostly be me, because I think my first experience of both bands was when my mum had taped a lot of albums, and they shared a single cassette. So I've always had them kind of linked in my head.
I think my first memory of U2 is the episode of Friends where Ross and Rachel have a break, and he promptly gets drunk and sleeps with the girl from the coffee shop. He was already sleeping with the girl from the coffee shop, because that was Rachel. Yeah. And U2 is playing at the end, but never mind. This is not a Friends podcast, thank fuck.
No, although, if you ever want to hear one, Meet My Friends, The Friends is very good fun, and a parody of these kind of recap podcasts. Okay. So yeah. This was an entertaining show. I liked the oddness of it. I felt kind of startled by Miles O'Brien, who I know often has a bad day, but the way he was acting, that was right at the start of people beginning to act odd, and felt like, oh shit, oh no, is he going to be a bad un here?
I mean, it was nice that, like, you know, this isn't O'Brien's worst day, because everyone's having a bad day right now.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, actually, someone who didn't seem to have too bad a day was Guinan, getting to play around for Gunn. A very non-Star Trek-looking gun. It felt like she'd nicked it out of some FPS or something.
Oh, it did have... I turned to Rihanna and go, she definitely calls that the BFG.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And fucking Gillespie. Like, oh, God, I hope Gillespie. Someone had words.
Oh, Gillespie. Man, okay. Two things. One, I wasn't expecting Worf to actually try and kill himself.
Yeah, that was a bit extreme.
Yeah, like, it's always great to kind of see when Michael Dorn gets to actually, you know, not just be, stand aside, I take very large steps.
Yeah. God, just that sense of him being like, yeah, he's lost his faculties. He's obviously, he's a defective Klingon. This needs to stop.
Yeah, it's like whenever in a big kind of X-Men storyline, when either Cyclops or Wolverine loses the faith. And you're like, oh shit, this is the sign of, like, things are bad.
Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah.
I do want to bring up one thing we definitely discussed in chat while watching the episode.
Oh yeah.
The bit when Picard's door chime for his office keeps being beeping. So I'm like, what if Worf is just playing a prank on Picard? I got some small enjoyment of the idea of Worf trying to be like the office prankster. But God. Because all his jokes are very much like they're funnier in the original Klingon, it just leads to being cringe.
Yeah, it feels like his jokes wouldn't land. He wouldn't realize that they're not funny, and everyone would immediately know he was the one that did the prank. I kind of would want, I'd like to see that now.
Like, I can just imagine like Star Trek or Deep Space Nine is like the office style kind of cringe comedy. And he's like the Ricky Gervais, where he thinks he's hilarious, and everyone else just thinks he's just obnoxious.
God, yeah, that'd be fun. I don't know, like, if it was an earlier season, I could see some of the ensigns daring Wesley to do that. Like, go on, he'll like it. He'll think it's funny.
Oh. Yeah, I did enjoy it. I think I had this confused with another episode. Because I had this confused with, I think there's an episode where the crew is having weird things happen to them, and then they discover they're being abducted on and experimented by aliens.
Yeah, that and one sounds fun.
And I think I was expecting that to be this episode, and then it wasn't. I'm like, oh, okay, they're just going nuts.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, on the whole, I enjoyed it. It was creepy. I think we might be the only ones who did, because, from what I've heard, the cast did not like this episode.
No. It sounds like it went through a lot of rewrites. It got a lot of cuts, and Jonathan Frakes felt that it was incredibly boring. And, like, I can't disagree, because there are so many quiet moments, and, like, everyone was kind of knackered during all this, and that just works.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't want them in a big lively episode if the actors were all shattered. Make use of it, you know?
Oh. I think it just had one of the nicest endings ever to an episode of Next Gen where Data's like, okay, Captain, go to bed.
Yeah. Oh.
Do you think Data can emit white noise? Do you think that's one of his many skills? That he just kind of goes on like the ship intercom, and then he just starts, his mouth just like dislocates open, and then just white noise just starts emitting from his gob.
Oh, that'd be great. I mean, it wouldn't. It'd be horrifying. But, yeah. I don't know. I feel he'd have offered to have done it in Unification when he was bunking with Picard.
Captain, I can do rain the sounds.
No, somehow this is worse, Data. Than just silently looking at me.
Captain, I have been working on my Peruvian throat singing.
Oh, God. Well, you know what we're going to have to do now?
Are we going to have to start talking about ghosts and get into a fight and start seeing conspiracy everywhere?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think Gillespie works sanitation? That might explain his disposition.
Oh, it'd better be in a really shit role.
Do you think Starfleet ships have a sanitation department?
I mean, a lot of it's probably automated.
Yeah, but you know you've got to have that one guy, like the guy who's basically the ship's rimmer, where like when you know like, you got your when you have you, there's no sort of like you just got to get a plunger in there.
Oh. Okay, apparently an operations division chief petty officer.
Okay, so yeah, he does the toilets.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, on that note, what we actually need to do is place this on our big list of best to worst. And that list has currently 136 entries on it. We are on the road to 150 now. Our number one spot is still Star Trek II Wrath of Khan. Then we've got down in spot number 50, we have Miri, where Kirk and the gang are down with the kids. In 100, we've got A Fistful of Data, where Worf really didn't want to be hanging out with a kid.
No.
And
no, I missed the spreadsheet.
Ah. And, yeah, finally, in 136, we have Plato's Stepchildren. And, yeah, Night Terrors is definitely further up on the list, I feel. Looking a bit further up, we've got a season 2 episode in spot number 64, which is Where Silence Has Lease, which is another one where people are going a bit mad, but this one's, that was a face in space doing it, trying to just pull the wings off of bugs. Almost, where this is people who are unintentionally driven mad and hallucinating, which I found a lot more fun, to be honest.
Yeah, this is definitely goes into the thing I think we like to bring up most, is that Star Trek is a lot weirder than Star Trek seems to think it is.
Yes, definitely.
Because, like, we have, okay, it's like cosmic entity, like, just experimenting with people. Yeah, that's Tuesday. But like we're stuck around this tiny rift which is just fucking with us, and it's just our brains unable to sometimes cope with the strangeness that is out here.
Yeah, well, unable to cope with the SOS from a different life form on the other side of it. So shit, they need help. We need to rescue them and ourselves. And anytime they're communicating with us, it drives us mad. You know, it's like in the X-Men, Mojo World is basically a dimensional area where our television signals have been beamed into their nightmares, and they've turned that into a belief system. And like when you realize that's why Mojo and Mojo World is like it is, it's fuck yeah. Yeah, you would go weird after a while of that. So yeah, I think it's better than Where Silence Has Lease. Let's see. The Empath also has some fun bits of madness.
I am actually going to bump up a few notches, and we have our old friend at number 59, for another one where the ship kind of go, where the crew just goes a bit weird in a very short space of time, and that's Genesis.
Again, like, what are the CVs of these people like? You know, like, yeah, I managed to survive thinking I was a marmot or something, you know? Yeah, yeah, I devolved into a gorilla at this point. I kept hallucinating people from a different starship and tried throttling a lamp.
Just, just like they're having an interview for, like, another job. It's like, was there ever a point in your previous job where you felt a severe challenge?
Yeah, yeah, but do the star principles, but this time it's Genesis, where you became a spider.
Yeah, well, there was this time when I became a spider, and I didn't cope with it quite well, but I coped with it. And then there's Worf, is like, was there a time, like, I don't want to talk about it. The court case is still pending.
Yeah, I've demanded to be stricken from the record.
Look, I will own up to killing Gowron, but I will not admit to the fact I once killed and ate a guy.
So, better or worse than Genesis? Though Genesis is wackier.
Genesis is wackier, but there were some, the creepy tone, which I get why, like, Jonathan Frakes would say this kind of feels very low energy. And, like, there are some cheesy bits, like the bit in the lift was, yeah, okay, that's trick photography 101, but it's always fun to see. Like, yeah, Worf trying to end himself. Like, the slow unraveling, Riker's hair progressively getting worse as he becomes just more and more disheveled. It's not as bad as it was with the hologram Riker and Unification.
No, that was a particularly bad look. Okay, so that had implied that this is above Genesis.
Yes.
Then, okay. What above there is kind of a limit here. We've got Field of Fire, which is a bit more of a kind of thrillery, suspensey thing in Spot 54, where Ezri and her dark passenger try to solve the murder.
We've got number 55, which is Heart of Glory, where Worf meets some Klingons and, you know, it doesn't go too well.
It doesn't. Yeah, that one's good fun as well.
Didn't that have Tony Todd in it? Or am I thinking of a different Star Trek?
I think you're thinking of a different one. Because, yeah, wasn't he someone actually... Yeah, Worf's brother. Okay. Yeah.
That said, Tony Todd, RIP.
Yeah, yeah, another great actor. Okay, so do you reckon this is better or worse than Heart of Glory, which was a shockingly good season one episode of TNG?
I think Heart of Glory is better. It does have that fantastic guy get shot through the floor of the upper level of... I mean, okay, sometimes... I love how the fact that sometimes criteria for what makes a good episode is, you know, sometimes, like, yes, we really appreciate the deep thematic underpinnings of Star Trek's entire philosophy and ethos. And other times it's just like, guy falls through floor. Great effect, mate.
Probably blew the special effects budget for that week, you know, and the slow-mo.
It's like, this is how you know I'm a Doctor Who fan. It's like, yeah, I really like the politics of the episode. It's just like, what do you like this one? The guy's blue, and it looks rubbish. Great.
Okay, so then we've got Where Pleasant Fountains Lie, which... I think this is probably better than...
Even though it does, you know, guest star the Jeffrey. Jeffrey the Combs.
Oh, good old Jeffrey. Yeah, I think overall, even with that, guest star's less impressive and important in this one, but it's still a very good fun time.
Yeah, I think I will probably have to agree.
Cool. So that puts it in the 56th place on our list. Yeah! So, our second episode of the evening is Star Trek Voyager Season 2, Episode 20, titled Investigations. This aired on the 13th of March, 1996. Teleplay by Jerry Taylor, story by Jeff Schnaufer, and Ed Bond, directed by Les Landau. The UK number one hit was Madonna with Frozen. The US number one hit was Celine Dion with My Heart Will Go On, love theme from Titanic. Yeah, my word, that Celine Dion was everywhere.
Yeah, I only actually finally got round to seeing Titanic like in the last few years. Rihanna really likes the film, but she was heavily into the Titanic, the ship itself and the explorer and the actual discovery, which you always feel right. When she brings up the film in conversation. It's like, oh no, I was a fan of the Titanic before, like, the film made it the huge cultural thing because, like, the love story and the Leonardo DiCaprio. And I admit, as, like, a 15-year-old boy, when this film came out, I was like, no, don't want to watch it. I'm like, nah, I watched it, and, like, yeah, it's a fun film. Technically, you know, I can't say anything wrong from a technical standpoint. I remember the French and Saunders parody at the time. I remember the Adam and Joe parody, which they did with stuffed toys. My God, that's a deep cut.
Wow. Yeah, I forget a lot of my experience with it, aside from it was one of my family's trips to the cinema, and I laughed when a guy kind of falls and bounces off the thing. Yeah, I managed to make an enemy of everyone in the audience, given how loud I laughed.
Okay, so I've already told my story about the scowls I got for laughing during the day after tomorrow, so I won't recount it there or here. Mm. But no, like, just I think my favorite was the guy who's hanging on just drinking. But then I found out that, like, a guy actually did that and survived. Like, there was a guy who basically, his idea was, I'm going to drink all the booze I can find and thus warm my body up. So when I hit that cold temperature, hopefully that'll keep me alive. And apparently it did.
Impressive.
Listeners, check out Pedant's Corner, because if I'm wrong or right, we'll have it there in the show notes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right. So, Miles, your news report has 5 minutes, otherwise we'll run over and the people doing the weather will get very upset. So, start that report now.
Welcome to Chatting with or Briefing with Neelix. 10 things you didn't know about child brides. Number 3 could surprise you. That's right. Ship's morale officer Neelix, which I think is an uncontested and unchallenged job position on Voyager, is now getting into the morning circuit. Later on, Mr. Motivator to get you pumping with some exercises and maybe some Richard and Judy. These are all very British references. Do some Google, guys. Anyway, Neelix is getting into the reporting gig. Harry Kim says, you must have truth in journalism. Always speak truth to power. Fuck you, Jeff Bezos. You cowardly piece of shit. So Neelix takes that to heart, and he gets communicated by a Talaxian training vessel who is going to be taking a member of Voyager's crew. And it turns out that Tom Paris, after a long bout of insubordination, is actually going to leave Voyager and join the Talaxian crew as a pilot, where he feels like his skills will best be suited. Neelix immediately makes it all about him and asks if it's his fault, and Paris is like, no, and they have a hug, and Neelix does a nice little bit on his show about how wonderful Tom Paris is, and everyone will appreciate him eventually, as Tom leaves. Meanwhile, the Doctor is just kind of demanding additional segments. The Voyager is heading to a specific destination, and suddenly there is an explosion in their warp core because they've discovered some mysterious messages. The Talaxian ship is attacked by the Kazons, and Tom Paris has been captured by the Kazon. Neelix continues to investigate these the mysterious messages, and Janeway and Tuvok, you know, get him up to say, kind of cut it out. This is a security matter. Tuvok will take care of it. To which Neelix says, yes, of course, Mr. Vulcan can take care of it, but apparently Talaxians also have the, if you cross your fingers behind your back, that means that you agreed to nothing. So Neelix gets on his best Elliot Gould in Capricorn 1 hat on and starts investigating to get to the bottom of the truth. And then he discovers that the person who sent the mysterious messages, who have potentially been a spy for the Kazons, was Tom Paris. What a twist! Meanwhile, Tom Paris is being harassed by Seska and the Klingon and the Kazons. Seska is now very pregnant, and she wants Tom to join them. Meanwhile, on Voyager, Neelix is just being himself, which is to say, he is annoying everybody to try and get to the truth. It turns out that Tom actually, Tuvok and Janeway uncovered the potential traitor, and so it's all been a ruse, and Tom was pretending to be the traitor to kind of rat the traitor out of hiding, and they didn't tell Chakotay. To which Chakotay's kind of pissed off, but Tuvok just kind of said, look, it's probably a member of the Maquis, and we didn't want there to create a conflict of interest, and Chakotay's not happy about that. So it turns out that the traitor is this guy, oh god, I can't remember his name.
But Jonas.
The Jonas Brothers. And it turns out that they've actually been, the destination they're going to is actually a trap for the Kazons to take over Voyager. Tom discovers this, messages Voyager, and escapes in an escape ship. Now it's a race against time. Meanwhile, Jonas is sabotaging the ship, and Neelix is in the same room as him, and sets up a force field so Neelix can't tell anyone, while Jonas deactivates the weapon systems. The Kazon arrive. The Voyager is helpless. And Neelix is able to overpower Jonas and accidentally flip him over into the warp core, killing Jonas instantly. Tom Paris is saved, and Seska and the Kazons are sent packing. And Neelix has another segment of his show where Tom Paris gets to kind of, do his YouTube apology video.
Oh. Oh. Just hit 5 minutes now. Let's see what's left, especially of Tom's apology video.
Tom apologizes for all the shit he pulled in their attempt to uncover the spy. Apart from all the shit he did to Chakotay, that was kind of fun. And that was a briefing with Neelix. Don't forget to click that like button, to click that like and subscribe button, and to ring the bell for further updates. Coming up next, 10 reasons why Jeff Bezos is a spineless piece of shit.
So, that's 21 seconds over, if I'm giving you the Jeff Bezos bit for
fantastic,
free.
Thank you.
So, oddly enough, today I had a training session where it was at my work. They were pretending to be giving one presentation while a couple of staff members were, one was on their phone, like crinkling packets of, like, I think a paper bag or something. One of them was loudly, constantly interrupting and fidgeting with stuff. And it was all a ruse. It was actually to show disruption and people misbehaving in the workplace and how to kind of start confronting people that do that sort of thing. This feels like a higher stakes version of that, of like, yeah, Tom Paris wasn't really a jerk, despite how we've written him for this season so far. You know, it was just a test, which, I mean, we've not seen all of season two, so I don't remember how bad he is for this.
Seen a few episodes here and there, and it's mostly been like Tom has been late to meetings, or he has a betting pool going on like Neutron. Okay, so is that what counts as insubordination in Starfleet?
Maybe. Yeah.
So I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you think Neelix would be a murderino?
I think so. I think he would be. Like, he would get very much into it.
Into true crime.
Oh yeah. God. I'm curious about is does the briefing with Neelix continue? Because it doesn't get stopped by the end of this. It's, oh god, apparently it does. It does continue.
Oh,
but
god.
It becomes, "Good morning, Voyager," which feels horrifyingly fitting. Because this, I thought it was going to be a news show that he was doing. Like, here's a morning briefing kind of thing. And as he started, like, oh no, he's invented daytime television.
No, he's doing Troy and Abbott in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly that kind of thing. Of like, here's a bit of cooking with Neelix, and then we're going to go to the Doctor, who I loved his constant terrible suggestions. Like, here is the dullest thing ever about medicine. Like, there could be some cool things. We're not going to cover those.
We're not going to cover that, but just the Doctor's increasing diva-hood, I think, yeah, is one of the most enjoyable character arcs in all of Star Trek.
Definitely. We've seen it when it went too far and he nearly left. And yeah, this feels like that kind of early stage of he's self-actualized. He's a person more than a hologram now. He's just a real diva, as you say there. So yeah, that was good fun.
I read somewhere that originally the episode was going to be all the Neelix stuff. And
yeah,
a bit more like a comedy, and then, but they changed it so we can actually see Tom Paris do a heroism.
Well, yeah, and just get it over with, because the whole traitor arc had been going on for a while now.
So did they ever explain why Jonas betrays Voyager? There's no kind of reason given. It's just like he betrays Mr. Kazon because reasons.
I mean, there probably is some kind of reason. It's odd, that sort of thing. Like, he's another ex-Marquis. Looks like working with Seska.
Okay.
So maybe that's why, you know, just like, yeah. Yeah, because we've seen him doing dodgy things on a few episodes.
I think Threshold, we saw him communicating with Seska. I mean, that would actually have been a really kind of a good way to tie this into Threshold. Would have been like, Tom's reason for leaving is like PTSD over the whole fucking space, becoming a space lizard.
Yeah. Oh god, actually, yeah, the thing we completely glossed over, Neelix killed a guy.
Yeah, but it was in defense. Well, he doesn't kill a guy. It's not like he killed a guy in the same way Worf definitely killed an Acer guy. It was more of, oh, you accidentally slapsticked you into the warp core.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be embarrassing.
Yeah, I mean, like, god, I mean, death by Neelix. That's bad.
Very few people have suffered it, and it's been embarrassing every single time.
So who do you think is going to be, like, Neelix's co-host on his show?
What, the Arbed to his Troy?
Yes, or the Fern Cotton to his Philip Schofield?
I don't know. I did my best to resist watching daytime TV when I was a student or ill.
Two
acceptable times to watch it.
Who would be the Ed the Duck to his Andy Peters?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I think watching his final interview there, Tom Paris.
Oh,
like, Tom is giving it. Like, he is, he's definitely playing to the camera. Yes, he is heartfeltly saying to everyone but Chakotay, "I'm sorry about the things that I said and did." But yeah, at the same time, he works for camera. He knows what he's doing more than Neelix.
So Tom would be the daytime, like, the co-host who is very clearly going to get his own show and leave Neelix behind.
Yeah, and maybe Harry Kim is like the intern in the field kind of thing. Of like, yeah, we've got him by this dangerous rift.
There's a lot of hugging in this episode.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting seeing them kind of close out an ongoing arc, and evidently they felt it was a bigger thing, in a way. I know Jeri Taylor was annoyed at having to bother with it at all. She just wanted to do the kind of morning show newspaper stuff, and it feels like that's been a bit of a path some of her shows, of going, actually, there is some nice bits of life going on in here.
Yeah, like, it's kind of like, okay, the show was kind of cringy by execution, but you kind of want to see life on Voyager. Like, you want to see how these people adapt to being in this new situation.
Yeah, you could even do that of go, yeah, here's this kind of docudrama. It feels kind of like you could do a whole episode of just him interviewing people around the ship and tell a story through that. Like, it would be an interesting narrative conceit.
I mean, Babylon 5 did an episode in its fourth season. There are two different episodes where Babylon 5 had, like, a day in the life newscast episode. I think they did one in season 2, where it's all done as a special report.
Well, and Lucy Lawless in Battlestar Galactica plays a reporter doing a similar sort of thing in one of the episodes there, which is good fun, especially with what happens with her in later seasons of the show.
I kind of feel sorry for Ethan Phillips at times because he has, like, the most thankless role.
Yeah, we've seen he has a range, like, he can do things.
He has a range, like, you know, he's like Jodie Whittaker as the Doctor. When he gets a chance to be kind of get that dark, crunchy material, he sells it.
Yeah.
Like with Jatrell, like he's fantastic in Jatrell. It's just that every so often he's just like, you know, he starts off as Del Boy in space and just doesn't kind of recapture like that dodgy, that kind of, I don't know, like.
The times that he comes back to it, it never quite lands because we've seen him be a complete unserious goof.
Yeah, you know, with Quark, like when we see him being like this dodgy criminal, it never feels out of touch from when he's doing like the Ferengi comedy stuff.
Yeah, it feels like he, Armin Shimerman can really reflect both being a sinister, shady piece of shit and the comedy guy.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ethan, who knows? We've not seen all of Voyager yet, so we might go through and go, actually, he's done more good than bad, but I still have my doubts.
Yeah, he just never seems to have, like, a set role.
Yeah.
He just seems to be, oh, he's kind of our comic relief, like, oh, Neelix. Will you ever learn that child brides are weird?
God, I mean, you should.
We're having more hiccups. That
happened there, yeah.
That Robert Beltran didn't like the way the ongoing story ended. Not really, because, like, Chakotay is just kind of portrayed to be like, we didn't tell you anything.
Yeah.
And you know what would have made the kind of the traitor subplot, I think, kind of work? Would be if it had been Chakotay.
Oh, yeah. That would have been great.
Like, if you had, like, you have the character who his big thing was, like, when he first born, like, oh, is there going to be a conflict? And then, not really. There's never, you know, Chakotay kind of just steps into line immediately. You never get a point where it's like, will he betray Voyager for the life of his unborn child?
Yeah. I know, I think he and Seska do get some scenes later on, but it did feel like he was kind of superfluous in this one.
Yeah.
You know, he was extraneous for purposes of it all. So I get Beltran's thought there. Apparently the guy that played Jonas enjoyed doing all this, but did slice off the tips of his fingers, bruised his ribs, and became a bit of a joke on set for it all, which is terrible. Going, yeah, apparently it took like a month to recover from the bruised ribs and yet still would have the piss taken out of him. Oh poor guy.
It's okay, he's dead.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I assume he didn't have many more shots, I guess, just whatever was in this episode. But yeah, so thinking of Jatrell, that's currently in spot number 76 on our big list. And that's got some, rather than, you know, funny Neelix has his morning show and does some investigations and slapsticks his way into success. That is, oh, yeah, war crimes have happened thanks to this guy. And Neelix is, like, down to destroy him, like, not happy about this guy existing at all. Like, it feels like Jatrell's definitely the more serious story. I don't know if it necessarily is more fun.
No, I...
You know, like, all the bits about the morning show, while they are frivolous, they're a good laugh.
They're a good laugh, but I don't think they constitute, like, a good unit of Trek.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, hey, we're wrapping up a plot line no one seemed to really want to do in the first place, but it's okay, because, like, Neelix has his morning show.
Yeah. Oh, dear. So, are you saying
should have been a podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe in the new Trek shows, there'll be some kind of, like, shipboard podcast.
I am looking... I mean, oh god, there are some good ones in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah, Stormy Weather was good fun. Treachery, Fate of the Great River.
Okay, number 93, which is Virtuoso.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Where the Doctor goes big diva.
So, I liked him being a big diva. I think this might be a little better.
All right. Above that, we've got number 92, which is TOS, which is What Are Little Girls Made Of, aka the episode with that one screen cap where William Shatner is holding a piece of polystyrene, which looks vaguely like a giant pink penis.
Oh God, yeah. God.
No contest, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, the one with a rock shaped like a dildo and the weird. Like
spinny thing and Lurch from the Addams Family and some Lovecraftian old ones BS. Like yeah. I think What a Little Girl's Made Of is the much more superior episode
for these very serious.
although Neelix, don't give up your day job, mate.
Yeah. So that puts this at spot number 93 on the list. And if people are concerned about our choices of why we're putting these on, this is still casual Trek.
Again, sometimes our criteria is meant. This is a fantastic meditation on the seriousness of being, and other times is William Shatner says sabotage weird, and that's great.
Yep. So our third episode of the evening is Back to Star Trek The Next Generation with Season 4, Episode 29, titled The Drumhead. This aired on 29th of April 1991, written by Jerry Taylor and directed by old Johnny Boy Frakes. UK number one hit was Chesney Hawkes' is The One and Only, and the US number one hit was Amy Grant with Baby Baby. So, yeah, Chesney Hawkes, I only remember in the briefest window of time as a musician, and this must be that window.
This is definitely one of those songs that got played all the damn time on the dance floor at the Hilton. Oh, so I've heard this song more. I think I've heard this song more than Chesney has heard it.
Probably. And, Amy Grant, I remember the name, but I did not remember her or music at all. The drumhead, though, I remember having an irrational thing when I was going through the bin bag of like tape to taped Star Trek episodes, where I saw one episode was called The Drumhead and was like, oh, that's going to be a wacky alien. I'm not watching this wacky alien show. And I was proved extremely wrong about what this was. And now I can share.
I feel like we should mention that this is the episode that gives us the Picard face, one of the many Picard facepalm gifts.
Yeah, that is very true.
And so I guess, like, why bother? Number one on the list. This is the most culturally important episode of Star Trek.
Wow. Okay. Before we do that placement of it, as is tradition, I will recap what this episode is all about. And it's not about a weird alien with a head like a drum. Spoilers.
Shame. Yeah. Shame.
I'm a lot more down for that kind of thing now.
I think Ultraman has definitely had an alien with a drum head.
Nice.
That sounds like the kind of thing an Ultraman show would give us for a Kaijin. And begin drumming.
Okay. So, we start in the middle of things. Oh my god. Jadan, a Klingon exobiologist who's been staying on the Enterprise as an exchange program, has been poking around the warp drive and was accused of selling specs to the Romulans. Coincidentally, the warp core also exploded a little, which isn't great. In his interrogation, Troy reckons that Jadan's hiding something, and when he's escorted to his quarters, he tries to get Worf to let him escape on a shuttle, saying he's basically nothing on the homeworld, given his dad's treachery, as he's been doing Romulan shenanigans as well. Worf isn't having any of it. Admiral Nora Sati and her weird-looking entourage show up to help out. She's been brought out of retirement for one last job, and everything's really nice and amicable with her and Picard for now. She checks out some footage for warp core explosion. There was no one there. Looks like some kind of articulation frame collapsed. Sensor logs show no problems. That's weird. Picard and Sati get to know each other a bit. Picard reckons it's disturbing that Klingons are selling intel to Romulans, and they may be allying because of things they've seen previously this season. Worf pops by to show off a syringe that Jadan uses for his Balthazar syndrome, but actually, it turns intelligence into biological data, so it can be injected into people and use them as unwitting messengers. The next wave of interrogation goes really well thanks to this syringe, and Jadan loses it. He says, Klingons are weak now. They should partner up with the Romulans. So they've basically got their culprit. That said, he insists he didn't sabotage the warp core, so did someone else do it? Picard gives a concerned look to camera as we go to break. Sati and JL have some more tea, and she mentions that she doesn't normally like working with people, but this has been good fun. Especially because he brings up how much he liked studying the works of her dad. He did a lot of writing about politics and the like, and ethics and all that, and yeah, apparently that is the way to get in her good books, by quoting her dad. Worf is still looking into Jadan. Apparently he didn't have many friends, and there aren't many leads. Sati questions Crusher about the injections Jadan had in sickbay, gets nothing from her, and then brings up a guy that's about one quarter Vulcan called Simon Tarsis. He's really nervous, and while he says he doesn't know anything, Saban, the betazoid of the interrogators, says he's hiding something really big. Picard doesn't like going off of betazoid intuition for a witch hunt, but is told, well, you use Troy's counsel fairly regularly, don't you? Touché. Engineering has access to the warp core again, and it looks like it was a defective component that was changed recently. Probably not sabotage, but that doesn't matter. Sati's not convinced. She's on the case. She wants to hunt some communists or witches, whatever. Basically, Simon. Speaking of which, Simon Tarsis is brought to a more public trial, and when his heritage is questioned about, you know, are you actually one quarter Romulan, he says he can't answer that as it might incriminate him. Sati also lies to him about there being evidence of sabotage for warp core when there isn't. Oh god, it's all got a bit much. JL talks to Worf, says he doesn't like this. It's like old military drumhead trials, the targets of whom were generally doomed. Having a Romulan granddad, that alone isn't sign of guilt. Worf says, well, if he's innocent, he'd have answered, but Picard knows that it's not always like that, and it's a slippery slope to witch hunting days here. Picard meets Tarsis and asks about his background. Basically, Tarsis was so enthusiastic, so eager, he enlisted rather than go study at the academy. He did lie about his background because he knew it would be a strike against him. Picard chases down Sati and says she's gone too far by trying to lie and induce a confession from Tarsis, but she doesn't give a shit. She doesn't like his tone. In fact, she's called in Starfleet Security's Admiral Thomas Henry to sit in on the trials, so suck it. Picard gets called up for questioning now. Sati says, you broke the Prime Directive like 9 times in 3 years, and sure, but he did the paperwork afterwards. It's all fine. She tries getting under his skin about how he was a Borg and about Worf's dad being a traitor. You can see she wants an emotional rise out of him. Picard has a think, doing that meme image kind of thing, and then starts quoting Sati's dad, talking about free speech and blindly stamping on freedoms being a bad thing. Sati loses her shit when...
Oh dear.
Well.
Okay. And continue.
Yeah, Sati loses her shit when she realizes what he's doing. And everyone seems to notice that she is not in a good place with any of this. Admiral Thomas Henry just gets up and silently walks out, which gives that air of, oh shit, she's in trouble. She excuses herself and leaves, as does everyone else. The court is adjourned. Afterwards, Worf meets up with Picard, who's brooding, looking out the window at the stars. Worf says it's all over. Henry called the trial off. Sati quietly left with her tail between her legs. Giles says, oh, you think you're better than the burning of witches, the torturing of heretics, and then something like this happens. Worf regrets that he believed her, and Picard says, yeah, there's always going to be people like her, spreading fear in the name of righteousness, playing on people's paranoia and hate, unfairly victimizing people. You need to keep an eye out for that sort of thing. You need to do your best to stop anyone who would use the name of hate in this kind of manner. And yeah, maybe we should take that into account. Maybe we should consider that. And that's the end.
1:20.
Yeah, I enjoyed this one.
Yeah.
It was a bit on the nose with the McCarthyism, but I feel, yeah, fine. Do it, you know?
So Charlie, yeah, you know, given the subject, what is your favourite Cormac McCarthy novel?
I've actually not read any. And yeah, slightly different. That'd be a very different McCarthyism. God, I don't know if I'd want to see that.
Okay. God. I will say this. Speaking as an honorary tax-paying member of Wisconsin,
yep.
Fuck Joseph McCarthy,
yep.
Who was from Wisconsin. Seriously, the guy who makes Ed Gein look good in terms of fucking Wisconsin locals.
Wow, you guys have some real claims to fame there.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure there's more than just those two, but Ed Gein and McCarthy would be...
Hang on, famous people from Wisconsin. Famous people from Wisconsin, let's have a
yeah,
look.
Yeah, win us back.
Chris Farley. Okay, Willem Dafoe.
Okay, yeah, job done.
Gene Wilder.
Okay.
Orson Welles.
Hmm.
Tony Shalhoub.
Oh, all right.
Who eventually will get to... Oh, Kurtwood Smith. He's the dad from That 70s Show.
Oh.
And he's also been in Star Trek. And he's the guy from RoboCop.
Oh my God. I'm getting a feeling this means we could do an Actors from Wisconsin episode.
Oh man, that would... Oh yeah. Orson Welles, Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Hmm. Well, there we go. It's not just murderers and complete pieces of shit.
Yeah. Yeah, this was a good one. Yes, okay, fine. It is. This has all the subtlety of, and now a very special episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah, fuck it. Like, I found the directorial style from Frakes really good here, especially because it is very much meeting rooms. Like, whether it's the ready room, whether it's the, what looks like the transporter room made up to be where they're doing a trial. I think that's what it was. It certainly looked that way. Yeah, doing some fun with the angles was good. And yeah, getting to see the warp core kind of shut off after an explosion. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, I don't normally see it all shut down like that.
All because of a faulty a plate.
Yeah.
You think Gillespie was behind that? The Arnold Judas Rimmer of Star Trek Next Generation.
Yeah, any other ship, it would have blown up entirely all because of Gillespie.
And killed the crew.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah.
I bet you Gillespie's from Wisconsin as well.
Probably. Yeah, unlike Tarsis from Mars, who I remember initially looking at him going, something's weird with his ears.
Weird with his
He's
ears.
He's got slightly bobbly, slightly odd ears. And of course, yeah, if his granddad's a Romulan, then yeah, that makes sense.
That just kind of was that, man, you know, usually when we have like people who are cross species in Star Trek, they're the direct descendant of two separate races.
Mm.
It's like, man, so how much of his Vulcan Romulan heritage is just kind of there?
Yeah. Yeah, he was good at being completely terrified and bad at trials, despite being completely innocent. Yeah, I did like that it was someone with a little bit of what we thought was Vulcan, but actually Romulan DNA, because, you know, in Discovery, you see a lot more blended species. You know, President is part human, part Bajoran, part Cardassian. And some of the students are like, I think that person's got a bit of Klingon in them. And it's an interesting idea to go, yeah, of course this would happen.
Yeah.
But we don't normally see it in this era.
I would say this era.
Yeah.
Although, Simon of Vulcan.
Oh. Well, Simon of Romulus. Not any better. Simon
That said, in Lower Decks, we have aliens who have human names.
We do.
So maybe it's like, we do. Like Jennifer.
Yeah. Yeah, well, maybe, you know, it's like, it's an exotic name, you know?
Do you think there are still people in the Star Trek future who are called Khaleesi? But because so much time has passed, Khaleesi has now become, like, a legitimate name.
It's lost all meaning and, yeah, become its own thing. Well, if I ever run the Star Trek RPG, I might have to put one in there now, just for the sake.
Oh great, we're going to have Captain Chesney.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, yeah, use our big Trek list where we've got the number one acts and name everyone after the musical acts.
Captain Chesney of Bajor.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Some terrible traitor called Sheeran.
God, yeah. This episode is really kind of... For timeline-wise, we're literally like 1 week past the US election.
Mm.
You may have been able to pick up some context clues. So like this was like, oh, this was unfortunately timed.
Yeah, So I was looking online, partly because I was like, what the fuck are these people wearing? Like, Sabine looked like he put his jumper on backwards. And Satie had a weird kind of open petal kind of on her dress and a necklace that was literally like a hanging judge kind of noose.
She looked like she was wearing what Laura Dern is wearing in The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
Like, doesn't wear it as well as Laura Dern in The Last Jedi.
Laura Dern. But, seeing some people going, well, actually, I think Satie was kind of right. It's like, no, you cunts. No. Like, I saw that partway through the episode going, oh, no, they'll completely undermine it if either Simon was... bad, actually.
A spy.
Or
yeah.
There was a spy. Them going, no, it was a technical fault because we're not infallible. Like, this is a great utopian future, but you can still have a faulty part. And this witch hunt was for nothing. That was the right move to make. And it is entirely what happened with things like...
The
witch hunts in Hollywood and all that.
Yeah, the blacklist thing. Don't forget that this is what, when was
1991.
This? 1991. If this had been an episode of Enterprise post Zindiar,
yeah,
you know it would be, oh, there are spies. Oh, she's justified because we got to break the rules, you know, to protect.
24 has definitely done that kind of thing. Yeah, where to the point where Kiefer Sutherland had to appear and go, oh no. Don't worry, not all Muslims are like this. And then you watch the episode which goes, yes, all Muslims are like this. Oh, terrible. So yeah, I am pleased that they took the decisions they did. You know, apparently it came from a Ron Moore story idea about witch hunts and McCarthyism. And yeah, you can totally see it. Having watched, you know, all of the BSG reboot, which had a ton of this in its first season. And, you know, again, some very specific episodes as it went on about these kind of witch hunts. So, yeah, I can see his fingerprint on this, which worked perfectly. So, yeah. And, like, the fact that Satie, before she did all that, was seeming reasonable and human and, you know, had all these amicable chats with Picard. This switch... of her going, no, she's got a quest. She is on a mission. Even someone you like, even someone that seems normal can be rubbish.
I feel like my one kind of negative comment about the episode would be she collapses immediately. Like, Picard quotes her dad, and she's like, how dare you? What do you know? And she basically turns into, like, Kevin, a teenager, having a stroke.
If there was a bit more time... where you could have had a bit of a back and forth before she completely unleashes.
Yeah.
That might have been a bit better. But yeah, this was a very good episode of, like, you know, season four feels like it's definitely got some of the high points of what you think the show is about and how it can be.
Do you know what I did enjoy?
Mm-hmm.
Satie asks Picard if he's gotten over his trauma from being assimilated by the Borg.
Mm.
And Jean-Luc Picard says, I've gotten over it. And as we all know, Picard is a filthy liar.
Yep. Yeah. Because look at First Contact. Look at every single goddamn
every
season
Borg,
of Picard.
Every Borg episode, every time the Borg turn up in a Star Trek Next Generation related area, Picard immediately goes back to like, oh, I am traumatized. Like, I think he's traumatized more than he has come to terms with his trauma from the Borg than Peter Parker has come to terms with the death of Gwen Stacy.
Possibly, yeah. Yeah, God, especially after the full run of Picard, I think, yeah, he probably does win that contest. Yeah, and like looking at Memory Alpha, this was going to be a clip show. Like, what the fuck? Like, I mean, the previous clip show we've not seen for this show. But it ain't good. Like, it's not...
No.
No, and...
I've seen it. I think it's him getting dragged into the big black pit from Skin of Evil, like, 15 times in a row.
God. But yeah, this could have been so much worse, as it turns out.
Yeah.
And yeah, this one, you know, it's a written by credit, so it's not just the teleplay or just the story that Jerry Taylor had with this. So, yeah, like, you get to see, again, similar marks like other people, like supporting cast members that aren't normally part of it, like Gillespie in our first episode, you know, like Traitor Boy, Jonas in the Voyager one. It feels like it's a bigger ship than just the cast, the core cast.
I thought it was going to be a bigger Worf episode than it kind of turned out to be, because you have the beginning with Worf and the Klingon, and then Worf's partnership with the Betazoid, and then the Betazoid immediately turning around to throw Worf's father back in Worf's face.
Oh, what a shit move. That was brilliant.
That was like, wow, dick move.
Oh, how dare you. Yeah, I loved that. That was, a nice bit of treachery there. And again, all by the books, all... You know,
yeah.
Proper official stuff. After all, this is all for Starfleet. It's like, yeah, it doesn't mean you're not a cunt as well. Like, but yes, so with all that in mind, where do we put this on our big list? Because it feels like one where we're going to need to scroll up a bit.
Okay, all right. I mean, I see you're around about the 20 mark.
Yeah, around 20. I was looking for some TNGs around there, and there's Preemptive Strike, where, you know, Ro switches sides to the Marquee, which is good fun.
I would say it's definitely up there.
Yeah.
Like, my two real flaws with it are, like, Sati is just immediately undone at the end.
Yeah.
And it just feels like, okay, so no one's ever quoted your dad back at you. At no point has this ever happened in your long career as, like, a judge or, like, an investigator. There is that 1991-ness just hanging over it, which is, you know, we have, unfortunately, a good 30 years to know that what is preached here is not very much not going to be the case, even 10 years later.
Yeah, okay.
And again, trouble is, like, that's not its fault.
No, no.
It's like, you know, it's sometimes, you know, we watch this stuff, and, you know, with things like the blackface in TOS, we kind of go, okay, that wasn't great, but it was 1960s television.
Yeah.
We don't excuse. And then, you know, we're watching something which has a very 1991 American view on the world. And we know, it's like with terrorism episode.
Yeah.
That we unfortunately suffer from the fact that we know how history is going to turn out. And we know the hypocrisies of Western society.
Yeah, I mean, this is where, like, Star Trek, a lot of the time, is not how things are, but how you would want them to be. Unfortunately, sometimes that does belie an amount of naivete, which you kind of can't get past so much, like the terrorism episode. Yeah, let's see. I mean, there's actually just underneath Preemptive Strike, we have Unification 1 and 2, which is another Jerry Taylor joint, which has some fun kind of underground stuff going on with Picard and Data going underground looking for Spock.
See, I was actually looking at number 19, The Conscience of the King.
Ooh.
Which is about Kirk, you know, trying to track down, you know, an escaped criminal, an escaped, like, war criminal. Mm. And the ramifications and the fallout where he's just a man trying to live his life, but the sins of his past won't escape him and have continued to contaminate his daughter.
Yeah.
Who is the real murderer of the story.
Yeah. God, that was a good one. Hmm. So what are you thinking, above or below that? Because, yeah, again, it's got that nice kind of tangle.
I'm thinking below that. I'm definitely looking at number 20, which is Preemptive Strike, where, I that's the penultimate episode of Star Trek Next Generation, and it ends with basically going, you guys are wrong. Like, your actions are wrong.
Yeah.
It's about, you know, it's trying to hound out, like, the traitors in society, and it's just like, the traitors might have a point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's, yeah, actually using the penultimate episode to play the Enterprise and the crew of it as more of an antagonistic role is quite a bold move there.
And, like, death, that's 3 years on, so it's amazing how the changes in both, like, the show and just the society of where we were.
Yeah, well, with that in mind, then, are we saying that Preemptive Strike is above the Drumhead, given the way in which we can't help but examine both of these in a 2024 lens?
Yeah. Like,
both are very, very good, but, yeah. It's...
Yeah, and then, do you think that this is better or worse than Unification?
So I liked Unification. Unification was good. I kind of prefer this.
Like, yeah, like, Unification is like a big, crunchy, epic space
opera. Yeah.
And, like, this is, you know, it's a bunch of character actors in a boardroom set talking about issues. As a unit of Trek, this is a unit of Trek to its core.
Because it's mostly in meeting rooms.
It's basically mostly in meeting rooms.
Oh, God. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I feel quite good about putting it there in number 21. Then above, yep. Unification, below Preemptive Strike.
Yep.
Cool. Okay, well, that is our episode. So all we have to do now is mention to folks what's going on next time and where they can find us. That's it for us. And next time we have a special guest star with Celeste from Celeste is Best, who is coming to talk to us about Romulans. So, if you like what we do here, and you want us to cover a specific episode or specific theme, head on over to ko-fi.com/casualtrek and press some gold pressed latinum into our palms. Other than that, you can find Casual Trek on Blue Sky, on casualtrek.bsky.social, and welcome, Twitter refugees. Miles, where can folks find you?
They can find me on Blue Sky at milesreedlibato.bsky.social, and they can find me on my blog at mareedlibato.wordpress.com.
Nice. Well, people can find me, however, on skyshark.bsky.social. My blog is fakedtales.com, and depending on when this airs, if we're nearing the end of November, then if you go to Dragon Meet in London, I'm going to be running around with either a press pass that I've received or have drawn hastily, talking to people about indie RPGs. Come and say hi. I've probably got an X-Men t-shirt on.
And other famous people from Wisconsin. We have Dan Harmon, Zack Snyder, and Buckaroo Banzai / Robocop himself, Peter Weller.
That's a real mixed bag. Well, on that note, go to a Starfleet and, don't do a Zack Snyder, but do have some sweet dreams, free from weird telepathic creatures.
And no matter where you go, there you are.
Wow.
Coming up next, Casual Trek against the World Crime League.
Oh, God.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and Tie podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Edited by the hosts and by Rihanna Reed Lobato. Star Trek is owned by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.